dear friends, is in this time of the Babylonian captivity for the Dems, is that what this is? In an increasingly bitter and lost time for National Democrats, their party seems to have entered a morass of confusion, accusations, recriminations, and agony amidst a deepening identity crisis. Directly before the inauguration, the party from the highest levels appears to have bought in or bought off on a plan to attempt to delegitimize not just the president, but by implication, the GOP itself and the very core beliefs of conservatism. It would seem the very act of delegitimization takes a very dubious position that if the left loses power, then they themselves instantly morph into a wise uncle who owns all definitions and authority and legitimacy. But having lost every lever of nationally and increasingly at a state level, how can the DNC, how can the Democratic Party, how can Democrats and liberals claim hyper-legitimacy when the people themselves have arisen to throw them off? And in other words, reject their theory of authority. Unless they themselves reject the very premises of constitutional democratic republicanism itself, is that what they're doing? So is this an effort at a massive self-destruct button for a bet that they will destroy not just Trump and the GOP, but the entire system itself? And in self-destruction, purge the disease, the so-called disease of conservatism or Trumpism, and then emerge reborn to run the world, just like Uncle Marx foretold? Well, I guess when you put it that way, the question answers itself. Good morning, Kelly, and it's 6:08. It's the 19th day of January, and a lot of stuff going on, and we are on the cusp of a new age, as you know. And if it's ever been true of anybody, if it's ever been true of anyone, I would wager that it is true of Obama, that he came in like a lion and he's leaving like a lamb. He came in roaring and making the most audacious and unlikely boasts, and taking his history of no experience and very questionable beliefs and convictions, and hyping them up into using the media machine into a mirage of the greatest leader in history. And now it's all lying in rubble at the feet of the Democrats. And so I have to say that it sure looks dire for the Democratic Party. Now, you can argue, as it is often argued, that it's always darkest before the dawn, that the darkest tunnel always has a light at somewhere at the end of it. But, you know, on the other hand, there's another way to look at it, is every movement has an ending. Every set of ideas, when it's applied, seems to run its course. Every party, well, I won't say every party has a pooper, but I think Barack has turned out to be the party pooper for the Dems, as he came in. He made a tragic error and the Democrats bought into it. And the error is of such a magnitude that it has to be pointed out. The error was to accept all of the praise, to buy into all of the plaudits, all of the hysteria, and to forget that there would be a day of reckoning if he wasn't perfect, and there would be a time when people wanted their money back, or people wanted to switch rides at the carnival, and that time has come, and the party itself is not ready for it, of course. And I mean, of course, Barack Obama appears to have really no functional ability to be able to to assess his own shortcomings and to present them to other people. Now, I would say, according to this as well, that the set of ideas that he's bought into, socialism, Marxism, leftism, progressivism, whatever you want to call it, is not really open to debate within the people that, that believe in it any more than the doctrines of Christianity are open for debate, any more than the Sharia law is open for debate, you know, amongst Muslims. So you can't throw off part of it. But, I mean, the Democratic Party is in a real, real tight spot, because what they did is they bet the House on not just getting power, which they did through Obama, but keeping power. And it was Obama's particular approach, specifically in his general attitude towards politics and the Democrats and such, that he personally built an empire but destroyed a larger one while making his own empire. And because his empire depended on the larger empire, his kingdom was within a larger epic, a larger scope, then his house falls as well, because he's revealed as a destroyer. And so, you know, Obama can claim to have a second act, but does anybody really want to hear from Obama, community organizer phase three? He did that community organizing before law school. He did it after law school. You can argue that he carried it on in his political career, the same strategies and ideas, and now he's going to do it again. So I don't really think people want that. But here's the thing, that, you know, his days are done. His race is run. And now we're looking at a party that is buying into delegitimization. If you think about that, you know, that is the biggest move of a loser I've ever seen. And I'm surprised that the party is, or I would say, I would say that I'm surprised that the party's doing that, except for the fact that they're doing it, because that's the logical conclusion of what they stand for, which is to delegitimize constitutionalism, republicanism, democratic movement within a republican theory of government. Democracy is one person, one vote. Republicanism diffuses power. So, for example, the House and the Senate are examples of republicanism, because it's representative power. But the theory that we buy into, which is representational government, the separation of powers between the court system and the presidency and the legislature, all of these things are examples of republicanism, and there's many, many examples. But the Democrats really don't buy into those separations of power. What they want to do is centralize all power. But when I say that, I mean a true socialist wants that. To have a separation of power is a distraction. It's a drag on getting done what you want. So they bet the House on nationalizing power. And if they could have kept Hillary in there, they could have continued to build on their gains. But it's like a termite-ridden house. It doesn't matter how beautiful, how grand it is, if it falls. So anyway, we are about to find out what Trump is made out of, and he doesn't seem to be slowed down by the delegitimization project. As a matter of fact, argue that he's gaining from this, because it makes him look more credible, because it makes the Democrats look crazy. If you can't win, then the other person is illegitimate is not a rational statement. All right, switching gears here at 617, George Michael died of crack Now, probably in more than one way, the more ways than one, but he had been trying to clean up his life, and his so-called friends, or his real friends say his so-called friends had dragged him back into hard drugs, including crack cocaine, before his death. He was trying to lead a normal life and given drugs by these people that he hung out with. And so he took too much of something right before his death, and he was a very unhappy person. And this is all from the Daily Mail, I think. Yeah. So anyway, addicted to a couple of different types of crack. His boyfriend explaining he had two long-term boyfriends in, let's say, the last 10 years, 15 years of his life. But he had told Piers Morgan at a party that he had slept with at least 500 men in the last couple of years. So, and with the drugs and all that, not a happy camper. Obviously not thrilled with life. So what a here, and that's what would you say, what they used to use these opportunities for was to teach the youngsters, the kids, the younger generation, the perils of fame. But we don't have that type of teaching anymore. In the same way, the society doesn't have the teaching to women, young women, girls, how to be a good wife, because this type of thing has been thrown out. This type of wisdom has been thrown out the window. But in the day, there would be attached to something like this a lesson. And the lesson would be something along the lines of, all that glitters is not gold. Be careful what you wish for. At the end of ultimate success and fame, there may be a lot of heartache, you know, that type of thing. But because we worship fame and stars now, it would be pointless to tell people that. Anyway, I've got somebody coming in, I believe at 6:30. I've got, let's see here, for your delectation. There, by the way, the FBI is currently investigating Trump's supposed ties to the Kremlin. In the meanwhile, the president makes a last press conference. I've never seen anyone cling to power like this guy. It's really extraordinary. Well, we'll get back into George later, but it is sad that this is a society that used to really be interested in wisdom, and it's really not. And I mean, it's just, you know, I don't think the vast majority of these people that are famous are happy individuals. That's just my observation, maybe you have to become famous to find that out. And anyway, I'll take a little break here. And a little feel good music this morning. Genesis, Follow Me, Follow You. Follow You, Follow Me, whatever. 620, Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450. We'll be back. And I'm going to have some weather for you. There's some extraordinary weather events going on. All right, so we've got from here, significant severe weather threat may develop in the south this weekend, including Texas. And this, of course, from the Weather Channel. Hold on just a second. I'm going to adjust the sound on this thing. But just extraordinary weather in the southeast from Texas over. And also there's another storm pounding the West Coast. Hold on just a second here.
Really rough day of flooding in Houston, Texas. You can see the Rice University Stadium here was dealing with some flooding. A lot of roads were flooded as well. So we're going to have to watch out for some flooding over the next couple of days in the southeast, really as a whole, because there's a lot of rain that's going to fall. But I want to focus the attention more to the worsening severe threat. Actually, as time has gone on, it's started to appear like the severe weather may be pretty significant, especially as we get into the weekend. Now, tonight, it won't be terrible. I mean, there is going to be some severe weather around. You'll have to watch out for a couple of storms with damaging wind and hail. But I would say the tornado threat does go up a little bit as we get closer to the weekend. So we catch a little bit of a break from the severe weather during the day on Friday. And then overnight Friday, we'll have to watch, especially near the Gulf Coast, as far east as maybe the beginning of the Florida Panhandle. Then Saturday, we've really got to watch out for the chance of at least a few tornadoes, especially if you live down really close to the Gulf Coast, right? That's where the highest tornado threat's going to be. And once again, on Sunday, this is a multi-day severe weather event. The threat's going to shift a little bit farther toward the east, I would say right along the Georgia-Florida border, probably where you'll have the highest chance of seeing a tornado or two, maybe a little bit farther toward the south in Florida as well.
All right, and here is a report that Houston is swamped by flooding, cars stranded, dozens of water rescues. And as you have been aware, if you paid any attention to the news the last year and a half, last 2 years, and I've tried to report as much as I can on the show, Houston has gone through a number of flooding events. And this is every other month, every 3 months, every 4 months, a fairly significant flood hitting Houston and sometimes Dallas, Fort Worth, and occasionally San Antonio and Austin. And it has been after 5 years of drought. And then the same thing in California. After years of drought, California is getting absolutely pounded. They're going to have 40 or 50 feet of snow in the mountains. Here we go from Houston. But it is a report that, and it looks like there doesn't look like there's any sound to this other than the little music. Flooding in Houston causing misery. Motorists abandoned cars until the water went down. So, you know, you continue to have this, and, you know, Houston's on the coast. Streets filled up after 2 days of heavy rain. And we've seen this time and time again for Houston. Now, here's the last report on the West Coast, which is truly enduring a round of epic storms. And the last storm dumped 20 plus feet of snow up in the mountains and 10, 20, 30 inches. Well, I would say a little bit over 20 inches of rain, but the same thing is coming back. Maybe not quite as bad, but this is a winter storm, Corey.
Open today, but it is way too icy. And
that's some pretty slippery stuff. That's video out of Yakima, Washington, and I'm sure the roads have been a mess in a lot of these spots. Portland, Oregon, one spot that's been particularly hard hit this winter. They had some snow several days ago, then some ice a couple of days ago on top of that. Now they've got rain. We've had a lot of snow in the high terrain in California. This is all winter storm Corey, all right? And it's not done yet. We've got several more days left, actually. It's just wave after wave of rain, snow, and ice at times in different spots. So you know the drill. You're probably starting to get used to this at this point. This winter has been very active. And, of course, this is all good news for the drought in the long term. But in the short term, it definitely causes some issues. A lot of rain coming to California, especially out in the Central Valley, Northern California as well. The coast of Northern California has a good chance at seeing around 3 inches of rain, maybe even more in some spots. Apart from that, up in the Sierra, we're talking about a couple additional feet of snow through Saturday on top of what's already fallen.
And so you have to think that at least 30 feet of snow up in those hills. We'll take a little break here and come back. I've got some local news for you, and I believe somebody's coming at 6:30. If not, Ben Rossin's going to be here at 7, so always good to talk to him. Kelly O'Connelly, I'm Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450, and 805-6180 on the text line, which I have right next to me, and we'll be right back. Just got a text, Kelly, 27.25 hours to go. What do you think about that, folks? All right, here's a little bit from Obama's last news conference. Who could I compare Obama to? Obama's like the prophet of a religion that is exposed as being a cult and is slowly dying, although he has still has some hardcore followers. A person who doesn't know anything, has no wisdom, has some experiences, some charm, a few tricks up his sleeve, but really doesn't have the wisdom that he thought he did. If he was wise when he came in, you'd never talk down to people if you're wise. In my opinion, that just antagonizes people, number one. And number two, to pretend you know everything at the beginning instead of the end well, to pretend that you know everything is obnoxious. To do it at the beginning makes you seem like a brat, you know, like a know-it-all teenager. Anyway, be that as it may, here's a little bit from Obama in his last news conference.
And as I said in my speech on Tuesday, we got more work to do on race. It is simply not true that things have gotten worse. They haven't. Things are getting better. And I have more confidence on racial issues in the next generation than I do in our generation or the previous generation.
Commentary, if you sell something on the idea that things are getting worse and things are terrible, it's hard to sell at the very end when you're leaving that things are getting better.
I think kids are smarter about it. They're more tolerant. They are more inclusive by instinct than we are. And hopefully my presidency maybe helped that along a little bit. But, you know, we... When we feel stress, when we feel pressure, when we're just fed information that encourages some of our worst instincts, we tend to fall back into some of the old racial fears and racial divisions and racial stereotypes.
We, when he says we, he means you, number one. And number two, everything is everybody else's fault is somebody else's fault is the far right's fault.
And it's very hard for us to break out of those and to listen and to think about people as people and imagine being in that person's shoes. And by the way, it's no longer a black and white issue alone. You got Hispanic folks and you got Asian folks. And this is not just the same old battles. We've got this stew that's bubbling up of people from everywhere, and we're going to have to make sure that we, in our own lives, in our own families, and workplaces, do a better job of treating everybody with basic respect and understanding that not everybody starts off in the same situation, and imagining what would it be like if you were born in an inner city and had no job prospects anywhere within a 20-mile radius. Or how does it feel being born in some rural county where there's no job opportunities in 20-mile radius? And seeing those two things as connected as opposed to separate. So, you know, we got work to do. But overall, I think on this front, the trend lines ultimately, I think, will be good.
My interpretation of that is not from his angle. I'm not going to put myself in the president's shoes. I've been doing that for 8 years already by, you know. But I would tend to think that the president deep down knows he's a failure, which is why he seems resigned. I mean, he's talking about this racial stew. Wasn't he supposed to cook up a post-racial stew? I mean, is that supposed to be our fault? What he talked about? You know, is it our fault that he picked up the topics that he did and went about them the way and in the manner that he did? Of course not. I mean, that was all his decision. And you know, when he first got in there, other than pretending that he knew everything, which is kind of amazing when you're kind of on the sidelines, and he was letting Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid do all the heavy lifting, and he got up there and gave these speeches that he's reading off this machine that somebody else writes and being called the greatest speaker of all time, which is really something when you think about it. I mean, that the left would do that. You know, I mean, so he gets to the end of his presidency and he says, by the way, newsflash, it's better to bring in changes It's better to bring in changes through legislation than it is to do it through executive order that can be canceled. All right, let's take a little break. Kelly O'Connor, 523-1450. Got my guest right around the corner. We'll be right back. Well, it is 6:43, and we're pleased to have in the studio a friend of the show, Patrick Hayes, and we have a little bit of a announcement to make.
That's fair to say.
And good morning, Patrick. How's it going?
Good, good. The weather's nice out. Not as cold as it has been the last couple of weeks. So, you know, being from Arizona.
Mm-hmm. You know, I gotcha.
Yeah.
Does this mean does your new position mean I can't call you Purple Hayes anymore?
I mean, you can. I mean, there's probably a little bit more blowback, but you know, for the most part, it should be okay.
But Patrick is is currently the media guy, is the voice of the district attorney's office, and has a background in media, and out of Arizona was involved in the television or the news industry over there, and then when he came here, he got involved with the DA for a while. And but was always on the back burner going back to news. So congratulations.
Thank you. Like Kelly mentioned, I will be starting at Channel 9 in El Paso and covering El Paso and Las Cruces News for News Channel 9 starting Monday. So I'm really excited about that. Glad to be in a position where I can like tell some good stories and stuff like that. So if you obviously have news tips, you know, feed them to me, feed them to Kelly, and we can work something out and get some good stories out there.
Well, and so it's obviously a much bigger market down there. But were you working in Yuma before? I'm trying to remember. Were you in Tucson or?
I was Tucson. I was in Yuma. I'm from Yuma, my hometown. So I reported there for a little bit, and then I did come out here and I moved to Las Cruces about 2.5 years ago. I spent about a year at K-Fox, and then that's when I started working at the district attorney's office. Mark D'Antonio, kind enough to give me a job, and then spent about a year there. Being their spokesperson, putting out their press releases, answering the media's questions. And when, you know, the opportunity became available, which it just recently did, I hopped back onto, you know, doing news. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you're staying in the area. Obviously, you've probably thought about returning home as well over the last year. But let me ask you, what's different from Yuma and Tucson from El Paso? What are some of the differences you've noticed?
Well, they're both border towns, but it's a lot of different kinds of people. You have UTEP, and in Yuma, you have a community college. So some different types of education. Yuma is also a huge agriculture town. There's a lot more to do in El Paso. I mean, Texas is very business-friendly from what I've seen. So you get a lot of franchises, the new Dave & Buster's. I heard they're building like a Topgolf out there. So there's a lot of things going on out there that you don't have in Yuma, just franchises and stuff you wouldn't see normally.
I think, though, from what I've seen, that the El Paso area has room for an up-and-coming, ambitious reporter. So I don't think that they've got news down there completely, there's a sense in El Paso, I don't know what it is, it just seems unsettled sometimes, like it's still getting an identity, it's still growing, it's still morphing out a little bit, you know?
No, I agree. Just being able to sit back this last year in the position I was in to see reporters do the stories, I could always imagine like, oh, what would my take be or what would my follow-up question be?
Yeah.
So, especially during the election season, not just, presidential election, but state and local elections too. You're like, no, like here's the follow-up question, ask about this or ask about that, or
sure,
why didn't you look at this? So having worked in the DA's office and with the DA even on his campaign a little bit, I now know kind of what to look for in terms of criminal justice system, plea deals, investigations, stuff of that nature, plus following campaign finance reports, a little bit of everything that I've been able to be a part of this last year. And I think it'll strengthen my ability as a reporter moving forward.
Absolutely. And so all of these experiences add up to a better ability, a better approach to reporting. But El Paso does have room to grow in some of these areas. Didn't even have talk radio as far as I know down there. And I mean, it's a fairly big city.
No, it's huge. And, part of their market includes Juarez, I know. So a lot of people, a lot of people don't get factored into like the listening audience and stuff like that. So I think there's a huge opportunity out there to, kind of expand the news coverage. I know in a building sense, they're growing the east side a lot. They're remodeling parts of the west side to, make room for more businesses. It's a lot of, I don't know the correct word is, but it's like that mixed where it's, an apartment complex with like restaurants on the bottom or something to that effect.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of that. And that's kind of what they're pushing for downtown here, which would be awesome as soon as they actually make it happen.
Well, we'll see. That remains to be seen, I guess. Seems like we're always trying to get born. We're always trying to, this is, I guess we're like a little brother to El Paso to the extent that we got some of the same issues that the economy is not actually vibrant here, but, 649 Kelly O'Connell here with Patrick Hayes, who has an exciting new promotion to tell us about. And we'll be right. We'll take one last little break here and come back and continue on with Patrick. All right. So anyway, we got Patrick Hayes here with us. So, Patrick, it's exciting for you to get down there. So this inauguration is exciting.
Yeah, it's definitely exciting. I mean, a lot of people, you know, for one reason or another, it's a very polarizing election season. And, you know, this is kind of kicking off, you know, another term. So whether you're happy or not, I mean, you should, you know, at least be interested in it.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You probably didn't hear the opening of the show, but I was focusing on the idea that you get voted out of office at every level. Nationally, you're voted out of the presidency, the House and the Senate. And at the state level, there's a decimation that's going on,
right,
taking more and more Democrats out of office. It's been a total catastrophe. And in the midst of that, or at the end of it, you stand up and say, I'm the person who decides who's legitimate.
Right.
It strikes me as totally bizarre. You know?
It's not like anywhere else where you would see something similar.
Yeah. Well, and not to try to draw you into a political discussion, but do you know anybody who's going to the inauguration or the Women's March?
There's a couple people. I know the Sun News ran some articles talking to a few of the people locally, and then I think there's a teenager going out there from Las Cruces going to the inauguration. That might be a tougher ticket to get, but I know locally the state has organized, or the state party, the Democrat Party has organized a bus to go out there and take people for those interested in participating in the Women's March. So I think New Mexico will be represented in different capacities, this coming week.
Or incapacities, as the case may be.
Yeah.
It's like for some analysis, it feels like, I don't know, it's all right. So it feels like we're in a new era when libertarianism is very popular and people are saying less rules, and they're also maybe contradicting themselves, saying less government. I want more help from the government, some people are saying, but a lot of other people are saying, get the government out of my business, because we've got the internet now to help ourselves. We have a, you know, generally speaking, larger economy. And people, I think, are more kind of able to stay up to date and everything. It seems like this old style of liberalism is almost an anachronism. It's like it's passing away. And I don't know if it's through strategic mistakes or it just people don't have that same fervor that they used to have for this kind of radical leftism. So I guess I'm just drawing a conclusion that we're moving into something new, but what it is, it doesn't appear exactly what it's going to be.
From like an outsider standpoint, I think that is one of the biggest problems one of the biggest arguments I heard during the election season was with Trump. You don't know what you're going to get. So that's a lot of people's complaint.
Isn't that always true with a new president? What the promises are versus the delivery of, you know?
No, I mean, like, there's always going to be some, you know, discrepancies between the campaign promises and then what's actually being done. But I think out of the candidates that people had to choose from, there was a conception or, you know, a perceived notion that, you know, Trump was the wild card and that he had, he'd have a more tendency to, the bigger tendency to do something drastic.
Crazy.
Yeah. So with that being said, I mean, that's probably what people were afraid of and not, you know, knowing to what to expect. But I mean, like you said, you know, we don't know what the new thing is yet, but there's definitely a dramatic shift occurring. So.
Now, from my perspective, you can't help but sense this. It's almost a feeling of religion in some of these people that are in the far left, and which is why I think they're kind of moving in this legitimacy. They're the keepers of reality. But I just think, general commentary for everybody, that this is a huge mistake for the Democrats, and to be the gatekeepers of authority and legitimacy. I think it's going to blow up in their face. They've got to rebuild their party.
No, there's a lot of, I mean, you see a lot of infighting amongst the party.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Republicans, they have the Tea Party, you know, Democrats, even down here, there's three or four different groups.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why you have a primary. So I think there does need to be, you know, for both parties, there needs to be some kind of conversation.
Obviously,
come together and, you know, focus on each of their own strategies. But, you know, as a whole, like, you would think the country hopefully will come together at least welcome the new president and give him a chance.
Yeah, give the guy a chance before you totally reject him and trash him, trash him for 8 years. But they're talking about Hillary running for mayor. They can't let loose of her, a mayor of New York. And I mean, now she seemed like she could barely walk when she was towards the tail end of the campaign. But anyway, I really think that the left has got to release this kind of this death grip that it has on their ideas and evolve into, you know, I think they've got to bring on a little more libertarianism. People want that. I think people that in our generation and in younger generations are growing up with more freedom, less rules, and they want to hang on to that.
They do. I think, you know, as a late 20-something-year-old, I mean, I definitely like at least having the conversation, whatever that may be. So, you know, I don't want one way or another shoved down my throat. But I think, you know, if you bring all sides to the table, you can definitely have that chance to, you know, explore every option.
All right. So we're going to be taking a break on the hour. You going to hang around?
I'm going to hang around.
We got Ben Rossin coming, in theory. But always good to have Ben here. So, and then we'll find out what's going on in the county. And we did have Isabella Solis come in. So other news stories. Well, let's see here. Joel McHale called Trump. He said he's like Iron Man. So I don't know if that'll make him more popular. Last call before the wall. Illegals flooding in at a record pace, folks. Be careful if you go down there. Keep your windows rolled up. 659 Kelly O'Connell, Amos Cruz, the same 1450. 523 1450. We'll be right back with a Rossin Report. And we have got 7:06 here. It is the 19th day of January. And, of course, it's Thursday. And what does that mean? Nothing more exciting could possibly happen than the Rossin Report.
Thank you, Kelly.
Ben Rossin is here. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
How's it going?
It's going real well, Kelly. How are you doing?
Good. So what's the latest?
Well, you know, Kelly, I thought I'd focus this morning. 2 days ago, we had some graduation rates be announced, and I think there's some great news for Doñana County, so I wanted to mention that this morning. Here in Doñana County, Kelly, in our three school districts, we had a graduation rate of 80%.
Wow.
Which is great when you compare it to the statewide average is only 71%. So it's another example of Southern New Mexico leading the way for New Mexico.
Wow.
Doñana County being a leader there. We still have a ways to go. The national average is 83%. But I think it's important to recognize good milestones and celebrate those as we hit them.
Yeah, better than kidney stones. I think when I moved here, it was 50%. Am I mistaken? I mean, maybe, wow. You know, I came here in 2008. So is that, wasn't the graduation rate 50% here for a while?
Boy, you know, Kelly, I know 80% is a fantastic number. I would be surprised if we were ever quite that low, but this is certainly a good uptick for us. And you might be right. I don't remember.
So what do you attribute the rise?
Well, you know, Kelly, there's a lot of different things that go into that. We've got school board elections coming up here in the next 2 weeks, and I think that's important to recognize, too. But, you know, when families are involved, when education is important in a community, it makes a big difference. And I think that's what we're seeing.
Well, that's good news. And you believe it's going to continue to go up?
I sure hope it will. You know, when we talk to employers that look at moving around the country or moving here, especially with the ones that we've got in Santa Teresa that have been coming in and even in the West Mesa Industrial Park for Las Cruces, one of the things that they're looking for is an educated workforce. And so as we show that higher level, it's a helpful in attracting businesses to come here.
Well, that's a great point. And so was there any I had asked the listeners of the show to call the mayor to see if he would talk to Seitel, and I have no idea if he did that, but if they would consider changing their mind. But it seems like if the president can, you know, persuade some businesses before he even gets into office, I was wondering if maybe there was something we could change in the county or the city that would, it was devastating to find out we're losing 400 jobs.
It sure is, Kelly. And, you know, one of the things that's going on with Seitel as they leave, we've had other call centers looking to Las Cruces before, and the problem was we never had a plug-and-play center. Well, now we have a center that's already there, ready to go. One of the conversations I understand that's taking place with Seitel is trying to keep all of the equipment there in the building because all the computers, all the desks, all that kind of stuff Seitel owns. And if we can keep all of that there in the facility, we've already had one person come by or one company come by to look at it. And I understand we've got two more in the next 2 weeks.
Well, that's actually what the mayor had announced, which I thought sounded bizarre. You know, we've got this facility. Will somebody please come use it?
Yeah.
But maybe that could happen. If that happens, then that's a good thing. I was discouraged to hear that they're still hiring in Albuquerque for Seitel.
Right.
So, I mean, there's obviously a difference between Bernalillo County and Doñana.
Well, and Kelly, I can draw a lot of those lines for you. You know,
go ahead.
We just start talking about tax rates. Of course, you and your listeners know, Kelly, that on the last county commission meeting, I had an item to decrease the tax rate. But the Albuquerque tax rate is 7%. The Albuquerque tax rate is 7% compared to ours at 8.3125%.
But a lot of people, especially people on the left, are going to say that's insignificant. That's not even going to be noted. What's your response as a business owner?
Well, not even as a business owner. As an individual, if you start taking 1.5% more of my money away, it becomes difficult for people to make ends meet. And, you know,
and that's the problem of incrementalism. A little bit more, a little bit more. And
always a little bit more.
Yeah, it won't make a difference.
Yeah, so I mean that's a significant issue right there, I think, and it's something that I hope that will change in the near future.
Well, okay, so you, shifting gears here, we have new people on the board. We have a new chairman, a chairwoman, chairperson. And what are, and I know that you're on friendlier terms with this chairman than the last, who is still clinging, hanging on like a barnacle on the Titanic, on the hull of the Titanic. And maybe we could buy, get him a one-way trip somewhere.
I think he's already taken his one-way trip, and wish him the best of luck in Florida.
I'm talking about Billy Garrett.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Well, I probably misspoke there. But, yeah, Billy's a nice guy. But it's the kind of leadership that lacks cutting-edge understanding of economics and, you know, human nature and also the needs of our community.
It is, Kelly, and I do think the point you made that the new commission is more receptive to that type of thing is very true. You know, we had a challenging meeting last Tuesday, or actually, I guess it was two Tuesdays ago now. But it was good. We had the opportunity to see where those new commissioners went. They sided with me on several important issues, and they sided with Billy on other ones. So I think we'll see the three new commissioners kind of finding a path down the middle.
Sure.
And
hopefully
the nice thing is that they're receptive to hearing from the
right.
public.
Although remember, the middle of the road is where it's most likely you get run over.
Well, I'm optimistic that with the new commissioners in, with Chairman Solis, that we'll see a friendlier attitude to the public and a more interest in hearing from people and listening and not just saying, I know what's best, here's what we're going to do, but actually listening to the people and finding out what works best for them.
And we've seen it on a national level. People don't want to have a form of government in which it's not representational.
That's right.
It's human nature. It's basic. It's so basic. People want to be heard. And the feeling is from people, especially for people, and I know that you grew up in this town, but for people who grew up in Doñana and have a significant interest here, they have a business, they own land, they've got family ties going back generations. They don't want someone to come in from another place like, say, I don't know, Florida, to tell them how to run their lives, what their values should be.
That's right, Kelly. And even at the commission meetings in the past year, people would come up to speak and they would get spoken down to and told, you don't understand what you're talking about. Why don't you do some research before you come back and talk to us? And that kind of attitude is absolutely wrong.
It's deplorable.
And so I'm happy with the new commission. Chairman Solis, I think, will do a much better job of that. She had one individual that needed more time to address the commission, and she gave that individual additional time. So I think that we'll see a much more responsive commission moving forward.
Well, that's nice. Now, what are some of your personal goals or the goals of your constituency in this coming term?
Well, you know, Kelly, in the last 2 years, I've really had a focus on roads and infrastructure. I'll keep that focus. We've got some good road projects that have been completed and are in the works. The Tile Road in Tortugas, finally getting that drainage project finished. That's an enormous project. We've had about 8 roads over in Las Alturas that we've gotten repaved, which is great. Working on some funding now with Soledad Canyon, repaving that road, and I think we'll have that. I'm working with the city on that, Kelly, because they're going to be putting in gas lines through there, and we want to make sure we get those utilities in before we redo the road. There's too many times where you build a new road, and then you come in and tear it up and put in the utilities. So we just have to make sure we get those done in the right order. But that'll be a continued focus for me. We'll be on dam maintenance and stormwater control.
Oh, that's pretty strong language from you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was thinking about, you know, some of these battles that we've had in the past that you've come on the show to talk about, are any of those going to be revisited, some of the struggles that we had and when the board had a different composition?
Absolutely. You know, Kelly, in our last meeting, we repealed one item that the previous commission had passed, which was very encouraging to me. One of the things that I do expect to come up in the next month or so is the Unified Development Code and looking at amendments to that. There's changes that need to be made, and I think this commission will be amenable to dealing with those and helping that document be a document we can live with.
I have some friends who are in the sheriff's department, and they were talking about the need for more deputies and the continuing hemorrhaging of deputies over to the city. But Is there any chance we could shut down the buses and transfer that money over? Or
you know? Absolutely. Well, I think, and they'll probably be two different things, but I do think the bus system will get the funding from Doñana County will disappear for that. We've got other priorities to put that in, and I think funding the sheriff's department is a really big one.
Yeah.
Whether huge. It's deputies or vehicles, you know, it's we get more deputies and don't have enough vehicles, and you've got another set of problems there. So you need different things to go along with that.
Yeah, but the ghost fleet, I mean, when do you think the ghost fleet will be shut down?
I hope that it'll be shut down in the next 6 months, and I think it could happen a lot earlier than that. You know, one of the challenges or one of the frustrating things for me, Kelly, is we've got this bus system, these four buses, supposedly so that we would help the underprivileged
the
in
poor.
The surrounding area. Yeah. Right. And yet what's really happening in there is the executive director who's supervising those four buses gets paid $124,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what's happening. And I think it's really shameful to use other people's needs to benefit your own pocket. And that's
Ouch.
What we're seeing on this.
Ouch. And you had stated there were empty rides. So there was it 120, 130 last month, I think?
Yeah, I think that was for the month of October from the trip from Anthony to Chaparral. KVIA did a big story on that. Jamie Warren did a good job on that, interviewing one individual that she found on there who says he rides the bus every couple times a week or something like that. He's never seen anybody else on it. He considers it his own personal limo. And you know, we start looking at that and you start looking at the dollars that are coming in and you realize that that bus route ran 100 and some times. I want to say 120 some times between Anthony and Chaparral, completely empty, except for the bus driver. And, you know, that isn't helping anybody. And so if we've got something that's not helping anybody, that's really only being used for one individual to make some good money out of it, that's not the way we ought to be using taxpayer money.
Yeah, but it does remind me of this ghost ship that they used to, you know, sailors would report seeing that was supposedly doomed to sail the seas forever. And I'm trying to remember the name of that.
At least the taxpayers didn't have to pay for that one, Kelly.
Well, you never know. I mean, it could have been maybe some ancient Rome put together, but it was, I'll find the, but it kind of reminds me of that. It's just, it's bizarre that they would be so enthusiastic about running. And so this is where leftist shibboleths or leftist convictions meet reality, meet the rubber of the road, you know?
That's right.
So, folks, we'll take a little break here. We have Ben on for his Rossin Report. We're going to come back. We're going to discuss anything else?
Kelly, I'll briefly mention what's on the agenda for next week before I take off.
You taking off right now?
No, when we come back.
All right. 719, Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1455, 23, 1450, and 805-61802 text. And we will be right back with Ben Ross.
Like it don't want the love of this man at all. And it's sure been a tough time.
It's 7:23, and here's the name of the ghost ship. Was the Flying Dutchman, a legendary ghost ship that can never make port and is doomed to sail the oceans forever. And back in the 17th century or the 1600s, they saw this, and we have a recurrence of the Flying Dutchman. These are buses that drive all day and all night. And sometimes people see famous long-dead Dona Ana residents in there and in the windows occasionally. And these buses can never come into a bus stop. And you're paying $1 million a year for these.
You know, Kelly, I do think that'll get fixed, and I'm very pleased to say that. I think that'll get fixed. But it'll be important, Kelly, for listeners that have a passionate view one way or the other on this to make sure their commissioners know how they feel. This is a commission that's going to listen to their constituents.
Yeah.
So reach out and talk to them.
And, you know, you couldn't get a person who's any more polite or nice, you know, kindly than Isabella Solis, you know?
Absolutely.
Solis, whatever.
Solis, yeah.
So anyway, that's, you guys are off to a good start, and you've got your yourself with a, speaking of ships, steady hand on the tiller.
Well, we'll keep working on it, and I am excited about the direction we're going. I think it's a better direction than where we were headed last year.
Which the last one was headed straight over the falls.
Well, we're changing that, which is good. You know, Kelly, we started out the Rawson Report talking about education, and I meant to remind everybody about the school board election that's coming up. Election day is, or early voting is already open at the Doñana County building. So if you'd like to vote early, you can vote in either the Hatch, Gadsden, or the Las Cruces Public School District, whichever one you live in, at the county building. You can vote in all three of those. And then, of course, Election Day coming up here, and that's two Tuesdays from now. But you can get all the polling sites there for February 7th by going on to the DoñanaCounty.org website, DoñanaCounty.org/elections. And then you'll see the 2017 school board election there for February 7th and all the locations that you can vote in. So that's coming up. And then, Kelly, next Tuesday is our next regular county commission meeting, and it's a great opportunity. We've got a public input section that if you've got something you want the commission to hear, take some time out of your day, come by at 9 o'clock and tell us what's on your mind.
That sounds good.
We've got several things on the agenda. Quite a few to do with the fire department. We'll be dealing with several things on the fire department there. We also have a approval of a new runway at the Jetport down in Santa Teresa, and some other things that are going on as well as a MOU with the sheriff and the union. And so just some of those normal business type items, but it'd be great to hear from constituents.
Absolutely. And your number?
My number is 649-4153. And all of the county commissioner's cell phones are listed on DoñanaCounty.org, so you can go on there and look up who your commissioner is or give me a call, and I'll be glad to help point you in the right direction.
And when is the Wayne Hancock going away party, and where is it?
Ah, thankfully, it's already done.
I would have wanted to go. Nobody invited me. No, I feel bad. Well, goodbye. Good luck. Is he back in Florida?
Yes, he is back in Florida.
Well, I guess Florida is the richer for having him back there, or maybe we're the richer. But in any event, great to have you on the show today, Ben.
Thank you very much, Kelly. You have a good day.
Thanks for sponsoring the show. And what can we find at the Builder Supply these days?
You know, Kelly, we're doing a lot right now with Pelican Coolers. Come on in, look for some coolers there. And, of course, doors and windows. We'll be glad to help anyone out with their needs. They can reach us at 524-3568, Trevisan, Nevada.
All right. Thanks a lot. And folks, we'll take a little break here and we'll be back in just a moment. 727 flying those friendly skies with little Bee Gees help. Fanny Be Tender. We'll be right back. All right, so, well, always good to have Ben on the show, and we also salute the new job opportunity for Patrick, alias Purple Haze. So, we've got this boycott coming up, and the boycott is supposed to invalidate Trump. Here's a little more from I hate to play any more clips of Obama, but here's one more tiny one.
Kevin Cork.
Thank you, Mr. President. You have been a strong supporter of the idea of a peaceful transfer of power, demonstrated not terribly far from the Rose Garden. And yet, even as you and I speak, there are more than five dozen Democrats that are going to boycott the inauguration of the incoming president. Do you support that? And what message would you send to Democrats to better demonstrate the peaceful transfer of power. And if I could follow, I wanted to ask you about your conversations with the president-elect previously, and without getting into too much of the personal side of it, I'm just curious, were you able to use that opportunity to convince him to take a fresh look at some of the important ideas that you will leave this office with, maintaining some semblance of the Affordable Care Act, some idea of keeping dreamers here in the country without fear of deportation? Were you able to use personal stories to try to convince him, and how successful were you?
Well, I won't go into details of my conversations with President-elect Trump. As I've said before, they are cordial. At times, they've been fairly lengthy, and they've been substantive. I can't tell you how convincing I've been. I think you'd have to ask him whether I've been convincing or not. I have offered my best advice, counsel, about certain issues, both foreign and domestic. And you know, my working assumption is that having won an election opposed to a number of my initiatives and certain aspects of my vision for where the country needs to go, it is appropriate for him to go forward with his vision and his values. And I don't expect that there's going to be enormous overlap. It may be that on certain issues, once he comes into office and he looks at the complexities of how to, in fact, provide health care for everybody, something he says he wants to do, or wants to make sure that he is encouraging job creation and wage growth in this country, that may lead him to some of the same conclusions that I arrived at once I got here. But I don't think we'll know until he has an actual chance to get sworn in and sit behind that desk. And I think a lot of his views are going to be shaped by his advisors, the people around him, which is why it's important to pay attention to these confirmation hearings. I can tell you that, and this is something I have told him, that this is a job of such magnitude that you can't do it by yourself. You are enormously reliant on a team, your cabinet, your senior White House staff, all the way to fairly junior folks in their 20s and 30s, but who are executing on significant responsibilities. And so how you put a team together to make sure that they're getting you the best information and they are teeing up the options from which you will ultimately make decisions, that's probably the most useful advice, the most constructive advice that I've been able to give him. That if you find yourself isolated because the process breaks down, or if you're only hearing from people who agree with you on everything, or if you haven't created a process that is fact-checking and probing and asking hard questions about policies or promises that you've made, that's when you start making mistakes. And as I indicated in some of my previous remarks, reality has a way of biting back if you're not paying attention to it. With respect to the inauguration, I'm not going to comment on those issues. All I know is I'm going to be there. So is Michelle. And I have been checking the weather, and I'm heartened by the fact that it won't be as cold as my first inauguration. That was cold.
Yeah. All right, so some of the comments from Obama on in his press conference. Some of the other things that he stated was that I don't see in talking about Israel, and obviously Obama has a problem with Israel. He doesn't like Israel or the way that they're running their country. On the two-state solution, he says, I don't see how this issue gets resolved in a way that maintains Israel as both Jewish and democracy, whatever that means. So that the left has a definition of democracy that is apparently outside of what everybody else uses the term to mean, because they're using it, misusing it, by claiming once again that Trump is not authentic, he's not legitimate, even though he was elected by way of the Founding Fathers' Electoral College into the presidency. So, you know, it's always something else with this guy. Here is some final messages for Trump. The moment is passing on Middle East peace, like I was just stating.
I continue to be significantly worried about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And I'm worried about it both because I think the status quo is unsustainable, that it is dangerous for Israel, that it is bad for Palestinians, it is bad for the region, and it is bad for America's national security. And, you know, I came into this office wanting to do everything I could to encourage serious peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians. Ultimately, what the parties to arrive at peace. What we can do is to arrive at peace. What we can do is encourage, but we can't force them to do it. And we believed, consistent with the position that had been taken with previous U.S. administrations for decades now, that it was important for us to send a signal, a wake-up call, that this moment may be passing. And Israeli voters and Palestinians need to understand that this moment may be passing. And hopefully that then creates a debate inside both Israeli and Palestinian communities that won't result immediately in peace, but at least will lead to a more sober assessment of what the alternatives are.
Well, and I mean, you know, what's been the response from the world, from Israel on Obama's ideas? I mean, he ended up stabbing him in the back. So the thing that the was put together by the Americans, and then we refused to, behind the scenes, which we refused to block in the Security Council meeting, was that the settlements were condemned in Israel. For those of you who are not aware, there is occupied land that was taken during a war, and the Israelis took it when they were attacked by the Arabs, by the neighboring countries, and they've built houses there. And ever since the war, these, you know, there's a demand to get it back on the Palestinian two state. They want their own state within Israel, which would be, it would seem to be a security risk if they had full autonomy there. But in any event, it doesn't seem like, it seems like the Middle East is a lot worse off than when Obama got into office. Just my opinion. 741, Kelly O'Connell, show you in Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450, and 805, 6180. I'll come back and I'll tell you about an astonishing and extremely reckless statement that CNN made. CNN obviously hates Obama's guts. Pardon me, Trump's guts. All right, you've got this cabal, this group of people that is trying to stop the presidency of Trump, and they want to throw stink bombs into, I'm not making this up, carbolic acid or whatever it's called, into the ducts, into the heating or cooling ducts in the building, throw stuff on the outfits of the people at the deplorable, is what they're calling the after party. And the left wants to just shut down to show that they're illegitimate. In the meantime, CNN put out a very crazy hypothetical that I think is irresponsible and also shows more antagonism towards Trump. But it is kind of fascinating to listen to Who would be put in charge if everybody got killed? Check this out. During the inauguration.
Just about every measure of America's security apparatus, including 28,000 law enforcement personnel, will be on the ground in Washington when President Obama hands off his office to Donald Trump on Friday. A near army in place to protect the leaders of all branches of government gathered in one place outside. And while officials stress there's no specific credible threat to this inauguration, tonight, due to a quirk in America's rules for succession, questions remain about just who would be in charge if an attack hit the incoming president, vice president, and congressional leaders just as the transfer of power is underway.
Here you have a very confusing line of succession. There.
According to the Constitution, if the president and vice president are killed or incapacitated, next in line is the House Speaker, then the president pro tempore of the Senate. But what if something happened to them at the inauguration, too? After that, it goes down the list of cabinet secretaries, starting with Secretary of State. On the day of the inauguration, as a precaution, a cabinet secretary called the designated presidential successor will not attend the inauguration, ready to step in if something happens. But it won't be a Trump cabinet secretary, since none of them have been confirmed yet. It will be an Obama appointee. No word from the White House on who that will be on Friday. Does the line of succession switch to the new president's lineup at noon?
In the inauguration, you have two lines of succession, one for the Barack Obama administration, which is still in place, and one which really won't be in place until Donald Trump is inaugurated, comes into office, and actually formally nominates and the Senate confirms his people. You might actually end up with a president from the prior administration because of a tragedy.
Adding to the confusion, by noon Friday, all of Obama's cabinet secretaries are expected to resign. John Kerry, the current Secretary of State, would be the first cabinet secretary in the line of succession, but he's out of office by noon. Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, may not be confirmed for another week or two. So who would be Secretary of State on Friday afternoon? According to State Department sources, the job would fall to the highest-ranking non-political official in the department, the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, Tom Shannon.
One of the most obscure possibilities is that someone who is an acting Secretary of State, someone lower down the line of the Secretary of State, State Department today, assumes the acting Secretary of State position, is in the line, and the worst happens, and that person becomes president, at least for a while.
The uncertainty creates the potential for chaos, high theater, or a hit TV drama.
Sir, you are now the president of the United States.
In ABC's Designated Survivor, Kiefer Sutherland plays an obscure cabinet secretary, unexpectedly thrust into the presidency after an attack at the Capitol during a State of the Union address. Former Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman once played that role in real life. In 1997, during an address by President Clinton to Congress, he was the designated survivor. He left Washington and went to his daughter's apartment in Manhattan. But he wasn't alone. The role is a serious one, and he says he was accompanied by a doctor, a military officer with access to the nuclear codes, and the Secret Service. But once the president's speech was over, Glickman declined a ride from his security detail. The security personnel left. Glickman had to hail a cab in bad weather.
I couldn't escape the irony.
Yeah. Can you imagine when Obama got elected? Can you imagine that someone doing a long, you know, one of the major networks doing a lengthy investigation into what happens if Obama gets killed on his way to the inauguration? That is so irresponsible. Trump, in the meantime, to immediately sign as many as 200 executive orders on targets targeting a wide range of Obama administration policies, according to Fox News analyst Napolitano. And we'll be right back to check that out. Take a little break here. Kelly O'Connelly, I'm Les Cruz, the same 1450, 749, 750 on the button. All right, so there's supposed to be this massive withdrawal of all of these, if you can imagine, Obama mandates. Check this out.
Tonight, after a vote in November that many argued was a sound rejection of his legacy, President Barack Obama took to the White House podium today to defend his 8 years in office and to address the possibility that President-elect Trump could begin to dismantle some of that legacy when he takes office on Friday.
I have offered my best advice, counsel, about certain issues, both foreign and domestic. And, you know, my working assumption is that having won an election opposed to a number of my initiatives and certain aspects of my vision for where the country needs to go, it is appropriate for him to go forward with his vision and his values. It may be that on certain issues, once he comes into office and he looks at the complexities of how to, in fact, provide health care for everybody, something he says he wants to do, or wants to make sure that he is encouraging job creation and wage growth in this country, that may lead him to some of the same conclusions that I arrived at once I got here.
That was this afternoon. President Obama went on to promise that in areas where he sees fit, he will speak up in his post-presidency life, a very different situation than his predecessor took on when he left office and went home to Texas and lived a fairly quiet life. Here now is Fox News senior judicial analyst, Judge Andrew Napolitano. So, Judge, executive orders, we understand there will be several that are likely to be signed on Friday. Which ones do you think will be top priority for then-President Donald Trump?
Probably things like immigration, where the President Obama, by executive orders, directed the government not to deport people who are here unlawfully if they had children while they were here. Probably clean air, where President Obama reduced the amount of pollutant parts per billion before the federal government's enforcement powers are triggered. Probably guns, because President Obama signed a horrific executive order directing the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to deem a single sale of a gun from you to me, from you to a nephew or a niece, as making you a dealer, thereby imposing upon you some of the most burdensome, onerous regulations in all the government. Donald Trump can undo all of that with a stroke of a pen. He cannot undo things like pardons, commutations, people otherwise set free from military or civilian jails, including Gitmo. Those things are done deals, and he can't touch them.
We could dig into each one of those, but let me ask you this. In your conversations with the president-elect, you have been very critical of President Obama for going too far with executive actions. We remember him talking about having a pen, having a phone. What is Donald Trump's philosophy in terms of executive action, given the fact that he's starting out here with 66 Democratic congressmen and women, not even showing up for his inauguration?
You know, when I saw him, the number was about 5. Now it's up to 66. I saw him 2 days ago. And he was saying to me, okay, so I got 5, 10, maybe 15 more tickets. Now he has a few hundred more tickets if these people have spouses and a couple of tickets allotted to them. So he's trying to look at it on the positive side. On the executive orders, he told me he expected to be signing 200 orders on Monday. He would sign what he needed to sign on Friday. There are certain things he must sign on Friday, and those things are the commissions authorizing the Secretary of State and the Attorney General to take their posts. Presumably, they will be confirmed by them. But the executive orders, he's going to wait until Monday. He didn't tell me what they were, but Martha, 200 is a lot. So to your question, his philosophy is to level the playing field, get rid of all the lawmaking that Barack Obama did by his executive orders, level the playing field, ask Congress to change laws that need to be changed. Now, what he will do if Congress doesn't give him what he wants, I don't know. He's probably going to get the lion's share of what he wants because he has a lot of goodwill and he has the Republican control of both houses.
All right. So Elizabeth Warren is put the education secretary, proposed Betsy DeVos, through the ringer. And then after the hearing, she refused to shake her hand. So very, very, very bitter left. And one of the leading lights is Elizabeth Warren. She's kind of the new Hillary, extremely left. So it's going to be just unbelievable fight. And don't forget our sponsor. Go Go Cafe, Cafe Go Go. And they're going to, they've got a new menu out for hors d'oeuvres and hog wings, and they're playing sports on the, it's a gourmet restaurant, but they do have a few big screens over the bar area. So they have a new bar in there across from Sam's Club. Go check it out. Open 7 days a week now. Go ask for Chef Jose and give his hand a shake. Anyway. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, and thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back in 22 hours. Ciao.
With my love.